This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars Maul Lockdown by Joe Schreiber. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. One, Cog Hive 7.
The first punch came at Maul sideways, spinning his upper body around with the sheer force of the impact and driving him back a half step before he fully recovered his equilibrium. Somewhere under his feet, the alloy plates of the cell's floor seemed to shiver and quake, threatening to give way. He spat out a tooth and wiped away the blood. The creature in front of him was a walking trophy case of previous kills. 2.5 meters high, its massive shoulders and upper torso encased in jagged plates of primitive armor that clearly had once served as the jawbone and carapace of a much larger predator, it seemed to occupy an entire corner of the prison cell. Maul stared at the thing. The gray slope of its face was a surgeon's nightmare of ritualistic scars, metal rings and studs, wire loops and hooks, with bluish sacs pulsating beneath its eyes, all of it siphoning down and inward toward a gaping, razor-toothed mouth. Even its arms seemed to have been plucked from two different organisms. The right hand was a blunt-knuckled fist, the left, an elongated spider-fingered claw. Together they formed a mallet and blade, one made for pounding, the other for slashing. It was the right that had come careening out of nowhere just seconds before, slamming Maul backward and knocking out one of his teeth. The thing reached down and picked up Maul's incisor from the floor of the cell. Straightening up, it shoved the tooth into an empty space in its own mouth, twisting it until it lodged in place. Then it grinned at Maul, as if asking how he liked the sight of one of his teeth in its mouth, another trophy for its collection. Maul gazed back at it. And then, the rage came. And the rage was good. The uniform they'd given him was a standard orange jumpsuit, whose heavy fabric cut off movement in most directions. Maul heard its seams ripping as he sprang at his opponent, closing the half-meter gap between them in less than a second. The thing responded exactly as he'd hoped, lunging up eagerly to meet his advance. Its mismatched arms pinwheeled wildly before it, swinging and clawing through the stale gray air of the cell, its voice screeching at him in a guttural, choking language he'd never heard before.
"Let those be your dying words," Maul thought. "Right here. Today."
Close enough now that he could smell the corpse stink pouring off it like rotten meat, he fell into a reflexive series of moves. Both hands shot out and grabbed the creature by its throat, hoisting it up over his head and squeezing until he felt the deep tendons of its neck beginning to give and weaken in his grip. There was a wet, muffled click from somewhere inside the thing's chest, and a sudden glut of warm, thick, sticky fluid began spurting up from its throat. Blood. Jet black. The sight of it gave Maul no satisfaction. Only the vaguely annoying realization that it never should have taken him this long to turn the battle to his advantage. Still, ending his opponent's life quickly would restore a certain necessary balance to the encounter. If not honor, at least vindication. He tightened his grip, and the screaming sound got louder, becoming a broken, bird-like squawk. More blood leapt up, inky black and viscous, and started pouring from its mouth and eye sockets.
Enough.
Executing a perfectly balanced spin, Maul swung the creature around and slammed it to the floor with a sharp clang, connecting hard enough that he felt the steel plates reverberate under his feet. The thing's head drooped on its broken neck, lolling sideways to expose the throbbing vessels beneath its gray flesh. Only now did Maul allow himself to exhale. As anticipated, he hadn't needed his lightsaber staff or the Force to dispatch this waste of flesh. Not that either was really an option. Staring down into the thing's face, he raised his foot and planted his heel in the exposed throat, ready to pulverize the trachea, or whatever the thing used for an airway, with one decisive stomp. For an instant, he met its sagging, inarticulate eyes. "Now," he instructed the thing, which seemed to be realizing that it was destined to finish out the final pathetic seconds of its life here in nameless obscurity.
Die.
All at once, with blinding speed, the creature yanked loose and burst upright, reaching behind its back to produce what appeared to be a long bow staff. As the staff blurred toward him, Maul realized that the weapon, which he'd first taken to be a piece of wood or some kind of biomechanical hybrid, was actually a living organism. A serpent whose head lashed out at lightning velocity, latching onto his face, slashing at his eyes. Maul recoiled, but it was too late. With a jolt, his vision was gone, burying him in instant darkness. This was the second time in as many seconds that the thing had caught him off guard. And now he knew why. The creature was somehow cut off from the Force, utterly detached from the deep field of heightened sensitivity from which he was constantly drawing information about his surroundings. The intuitive sensory abilities that he took for granted in any normal battle were simply not there. An acidic heaviness took hold of his optic nerves like a slow drip, seeping in, sinking deep. And he realized that he could already feel the poison taking control, spreading out in concentric layers of numbness through the muscle and tissue of his face. Now the thing's shrieking laughter was everywhere. Willful. Triumphant.
"You must end this now."
Maul straightened. The voice in his head was his own, an austere evocation of his own training. But the cadence was unmistakably his master's. An echo of pitiless instruction, hours, days, years of unyielding pain and discipline. Sidious was never far from him. The evocation of the Sith Lord's presence here snapped him back instantly into the moment with total clarity. Reaching up through blindness, Maul took hold of the serpent, grappling with its fully extended length. Somewhere in the void, he could feel the rippling, leathery sinew of the staff looping around his neck, felt the hundreds of small muscles twisting and constricting over his windpipe, pinching off his airway like a living noose. The next few seconds would be crucial. He flexed, bent his head, and jerked it forward, but the thing would not release. It kept encircling him, looping round and round, defying every attempt to take hold of it. Maul willed himself to be absolutely still, a study in perfect rigidity, allowing the serpent, in its moment of fatal overconfidence, to draw tighter still, stretching itself until he sensed its head coming back around in front of him once more. Still, he waited. Above it all, he could smell his opponent's fetid stench, could feel the claws of his opponent raking his skin, twisting into his face, gouging for purchase. It shrieked at him, and this time, the cry was pure victory. What might even have been laughter. Starved, insane, a warrior with nothing to lose.
"You are no warrior,"
Maul thought.
You know nothing of the dark side.
The moment had come. He grasped the head of the amphistaff, seizing its blunt nose and fanged mouth. His fingers took hold of its distended upper part, twisting, wrenching, until he tore the serpent's head off its body with a moist and meaty pop. The results were instantaneous. With a twitching galvanic shudder, the snake loosened and fell slack, the coils already beginning to slide from his neck, and Maul allowed himself a single, unobstructed breath before finishing his work here. Somewhere in front of him, the attacker had already responded to the death of his weapon with a howl of cheated rage. Maul no longer heard it. Primal as it was, it was still only emotion. A cry of weakness no more instructive or relevant than the pain he'd willed away moments earlier. He had no more use for it now than he ever did. He did, however, take advantage of his opponent's scream just long enough to reach into its open mouth, feeling the moist warmth of its breath on his hand as he retrieved his tooth, plucking it from the thing's gums. Holding the mouth agape, Maul crammed the serpent's severed head inside, then clamped the gray lips tight to keep the snake's head from falling out. He ripped three of the larger piercings from the thing's right arm and jammed them upward through the lips, bending them back into barbed hooks and fastening the mouth shut with the serpent's head still trapped inside. With his hands flattened against those lips, Maul could feel the head twitching around inside the mouth, sinking its fangs in reflexively, squirting out venom while his attacker jerked and spasmed and tried in vain to scream.
End it.
Still sightless, now holding his opponent at arm's length, Maul inclined his own head down. He thrust forward, driving his horns into the thing's sagging eyes, feeling them crushed to jelly against his scalp. The spasm stopped, and Maul stepped back, releasing the body, allowing it to collapse at his feet. He blinked and narrowed his own still-burning eyes, clutching his tooth in his hand. His vision was already starting to come back in murky shades of gunmetal gray and metallic blue. The process was infuriatingly slow, but it was happening. There was no reason not to assume that within a few hours he would be fully recovered, and when... The floor began to shake. Maul whipped around, scanning the depths of his cell for the vibration source. From all around him, a ratcheting cacophony had taken hold of the cell. The sound of massive chains being dragged through the sprockets and pulleys of some vast piece of clockwork. It filled the entire chamber, rising to a deafening roar. Everything around him had begun to shift and tilt. Maul reached out, fingertips confirming what he'd already begun to suspect. The walls were closing in. This was no illusion, no side effect of crippled vision. The cell itself was literally changing shape. The individual steel plates that formed the walls and floors and ceiling, all overlapping and sliding together like great mechanical scales, curving inward as the slant of its floor became steeper, transforming into a kind of bowl, opening in the middle to create a funnel. Reaching backward, Maul grabbed the handhold bolted into the bench behind him, clutching it for balance and holding on tight. All around him, the grating howl and shriek of metal got louder as a hole opened in the middle of the floor. He furrowed his brow, squinting down into it. His vision had become clear enough now that he could make out the lifeless corpse of his former attacker, the thing in its broken and now utterly useless organic armor, sliding downward toward the center of the cell. It sagged forward on a streaking smear of its own black blood, a slave to simple physics, its passage into oblivion followed in short order by the limp, decapitated body of the snake staff. Maul watched as warrior and staff both slipped through the hole and out of sight, into a bath of darkness almost as deep as the one from which he himself had just emerged. For an instant, was it real? He thought he saw something pale and eyeless reaching up to suck the bodies down. The hole closed again, and the floor shifted itself, smoothing out and becoming flat once more. The clanking and shaking stopped. The cell around him had resumed its previous rectilinear shape. Somewhere in front of him, a panel of red lights blinked and went green. He waited as the cell began to carry him upward. 2. Siddiqui. Stepping inside her office, Warden Siddiqui Blur flicked her gaze up at the bank of holoscreens that ran the length of the wall like a jury of accusatory eyes. A few of the screens were dedicated surveillance feeds, displaying different areas of the prison. The mess hall, the med bay, the warren of concourses, tunnels, and catwalks that branched like spokes off the vast open gallery area where inmates milled about before and after matches. The majority of the screens, however, represented incoming calls waiting for her. A queue of holonet conversations with bookies, bureaucrats, and the heads of various gambling combines, all no doubt in response to last night's bout.
Good morning, Warden.
The 3D4 admin droid announced cheerily as Siddiqui crossed the office.
And how are we feeling this morning?
Living the dream. She settled in behind the central console, where her morning coffee was already waiting. Leaning forward, she fingerprinted in the biometric code to bring up her morning schedule, watching the vivid swaths of data wash scrolling over the tablets in front of her. Pull up the holo vid of last night's match, would you?
Of course.
3D responded, and turned its head to the row of waiting calls.
However, as you can imagine, we already have several representatives from the casinos and the gaming commission who are extremely interested in...
They can wait.
Perhaps I ought to remind you also of your morning meeting with...
Thanks for your input, Siddiqui said without glancing up. Is the holovid ready?
Certainly,
3D said crisply.
You wish for me to replay it from the beginning?
Would you mind terribly?
Not at all.
The admin droid had been working with her for 3 years, and its sheer obliviousness to her sarcasm was one of its most endearing traits. It chirped and swiveled, and its dedicated holoprojector fluttered to life, already making subtle adjustments to amplitude and phase modulations to enhance the image. Behind her desk, Siddiqui sat back, put her feet up, and took a sip of coffee, as the entire wall of her office filled with the footage of last night's fight. This would be the third time she'd watched it. She made it a habit to view every match at least twice, once live, as it was happening, and then later with a more analytical eye for the strengths and weaknesses of the individual fighters. What she'd discovered over hundreds of fights was that sometimes, upon repeated viewings, the fight itself would emerge like some third organism, something bigger than either of the combatants, a kind of composite presence knitted together of sweat, desperation, and perhaps unexpected elegance, with a personality all its own. Last night's former champion had been a particularly monstrous species that the Prism's most sophisticated recognition algorithm hadn't been able to identify. 2 meters tall and cross-hatched with ritualistic scars, brandishing some kind of living staff and little else, the inmate had arrived here on Coghive 7 6 standard months earlier with a shipment of other convicts, 2 of whom it had already dispatched in transit. Since that time, the thing had defied all attempts at classification. It had screeched and chattered a language none of them recognized, and systematically slaughtered everything pitted against it. Some of the guards thought it was female. On the other side was the newly arrived inmate, a bold and muscular Zabrak, red-skinned, covered with black tattoos and a crown of 10 vestigial horns. Even now, after repeated viewings, Siddiqui couldn't take her eyes off him. In the final moments, when the challenger destroyed the amphistaff, literally ripping off its head and feeding it to his opponent, she'd felt a dark tremor of excitement that she hadn't experienced in ages. It was, she supposed, the same primal fascination that kept the gamblers across the galaxy betting millions of credits as they gathered to watch live holo feeds of the contests. When the fight was over, she froze the holo on the face of the new champion, his red skin and yellow eyes glaring back at her. Gazing at it, she took a thoughtful sip of her coffee. "He took back his tooth," she said finally. 3D's head swiveled back toward her.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Our new champion. Before he killed his opponent, he took back his tooth."
"Perhaps it is customary for his species to..."
"What's his name?" she asked. "The new inmate."
"Prisoner 11240. I've already taken the liberty of uploading all relevant data onto your tablet."
Siddiqui punched the numbers into the console in front of her, watching her new champion's file scroll across the screen. It read, "Inmate 11240. Date of entry, 011022-11224. Name, Jagannath. Species, Zabrak. Gender, male. Height, 1.75 meters. Mass, 80 kilograms. Eyes, yellow. Skin, red. Prior occupation, mercenary. Charged with murder." "That's it?" Siddiqui stabbed the cursor down, but the screen was blank. "Where's the rest of it?"
"There is no more."
"Where did he come from? Can somebody at least tell me that?"
"He was apprehended on a routine sweep of the mining colonies on Subterral, where local authorities identified him from an outstanding murder charge. Initial lab cultures and blood work are still pending."
The droid clicked and whirred toward her, photoreceptors brightening.
"So far, he has eluded any more detailed classification. Would you like me to order a full psychiatric workup?"
Siddiqui considered before shaking her head. "No, not yet. For now, let's see how long he lasts. He wouldn't be the first big noise to come through here and pull a quick fade."
"Of course. If there's nothing else, I have Gaming Commissioner Cloris for you. And Eamon Hoang of the casino on Ando Prime. Whom would you like to speak to first?"
"Cloris." Siddiqui found herself reaching up instinctively to check her reflection in the nearest screen, sweeping her fingers through her bangs. "Put him through."
"Very good."
The holovid switched over to a life-sized image of a silver-haired, distinguished-looking human in a double-faced worsted greatcoat that tapered smoothly down to his ankles. Dragomir Cloris was at least 60, but his olive-eyed, almost tropically tanned face appeared 20 years younger, even furrowed with the lines of impatience that he wore now. "Commissioner?" Siddiqui said, raising her cup in mock salute. "You're looking dashing as always. One day, you'll have to tell me your secret for never aging a day. Is it dietary?"
"Yes," Cloris said dryly. "I've eliminated all gratuitous flattery from my diet."
That famous scowl deepened, drawing deep brackets along either side of his mouth.
"Now I trust that takes care of the pleasantries between us."
Siddiqui sipped coffee and nodded. "Apparently so."
"Good. You've kept me waiting quite long enough, Warden. And regardless of what you might have heard, the galaxy does not revolve around you."
"Sadly, no." Siddiqui smiled, eyebrows raised. "But there was a time, wasn't there? Cloris blinked.
I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about.
Of course not, she said, still smiling.
Well, give me a moment to put on my penitent cap, and then you can tell me what I've done today to offend the delicate sensibilities of the Galactic Gaming Commission. This isn't an occasion for levity, Warden. Exactly what sort of operation are you running out there?
Siddiqui's eyebrows spiked. My goodness, we are formal this morning. And then, folding her hands on her desk, all right. Well, as you know, Commissioner, Coghive 7 embodies a profitable gambling industry while providing a valuable service to millions of...
I think we can bypass the investment propaganda. I want to know about that new inmate from last night's bout. And I want to know exactly how many credits you won when he tore his opponent apart.
Me, personally?
Don't play coy with me. You'll discover that I have neither the time nor the temperament for it.
Oh, dear. And I liked to think that I'd already discovered everything there was to know about you. Lowering her head, Siddiqui flashed him her best innocent look. I take it that your constituents weren't satisfied with the outcome of the match.
To say the least. And this morning you've got odds makers and casinos from every core planet yanking their hair out over this business. Frankly, I don't blame them. Your reigning champion, whatever that thing was favored by an outlandishly large advantage. He'd won 6 straight fights in a row. But that Zabrak beat him handily.
He beat the odds, Siddiqui said and shrugged. That's why they call it an upset.
May I remind you of how often that has happened recently in your facility?
Now hold on just a moment. Siddiqui sat forward. You're not implying that we enjoy an unfair advantage.
I never...
As you know, my brother and I determine the odds of every fight by a unique algorithm based on the fighting history, weight, criminal record, and all sorts of mitigating factors, the specifics of which are available to our millions of subscribers. Whether or not those individual elements add up a win, of course, is never a sure thing. She shrugged again. Which is why it's considered gambling.
Yet the house always wins.
As do millions of others. She looked at him carefully. It's a business, Commissioner.
An insanely profitable one.
Is that a question? Cloris cleared his throat.
Since its inception, there's no question that Coghive 7 has enjoyed an unprecedented popularity among the gambling community.
Good of you to say so.
But at this point, I'd remind you to be aware of the fact that there are an increasing number of casino owners, galactic bankers, and...
Cloris hesitated.
Particularly the small-time crime syndicates that control the gambling activity in the Outer Rim, all of whom have taken notice of how regularly you set the odds and then proceed to beat them.
Which syndicates are we talking about exactly? And isn't that sort of thing really outside your scope of influence?
You're not hearing me.
Oh, I think I am. You're worried about the Commission saving face among its IBC cronies and upholding your personal reputation for being tough on corruption and organized crime. All of which I respect. But I hardly think you need to threaten me with fines.
Fines!
Cloris leaned slightly forward, and his voice softened, becoming almost gentle.
Siddiqui, I'm going to stop you right there. I know your proclivity for unorthodox behavior, but out of respect for our shared history, I want you to consider this a friendly warning.
He paused, sighed like a man about to lift a particularly unwieldy weight. then gathered himself and continued.
If Coghive 7 is using insider information to place its own bets, then you, of all people, should know that the Gaming Commission is the last thing you need to worry about.
Meaning what, exactly? I'll have a mob of Black Sun Vigos showing up and throwing their weight around my prison? She gave a throaty chuckle. Respectfully, I'd like to see them try.
Not necessarily Black Sun.
Who then? Cloris cast an uneasy glance to the right at something off-screen that she couldn't see.
I've said enough. Goodbye, Siddiqui.
Wait a second, but his face was gone. Cloris had already cut off the transmission. Leaning back into her seat with a sigh, Siddiqui reached for her coffee, only to find that it had gone cold. Lovely. She glanced around the office for her droid. 3D, can you please heat this up for me and find out whom I'm supposed to placate next?
I think, a voice said from the doorway, that should probably be me.
Siddiqui glanced up at the tall, slender moon who seemed to have materialized without warning in the office's open hatchway. She saw with a certain resigned dismay that he was dressed in signatory, paleo fiduciary garb, a round-collared green tunic, form-fitting trousers and boots. The uniform told her all that she needed to know about who he was and, in all likelihood, why he'd come. With a cool smile, she rose from behind her desk. I'm sorry, do we know each other?
Vesto Slipher, the moon said. Intergalactic banking clan. We've spoken before by hollow feed, but I've never had the pleasure of a face-to-face encounter.
Well, she allowed the smile to retract just slightly into the corners of her mouth. Always a pleasure to host an unexpected visit from the IBC.
Really? Slipher's smile matched her own. Your expression tells me otherwise.
Oh, don't take it personally. It's been that kind of morning. Siddiqui glanced at 3D, then back at Slipher. Are you on my schedule?
I tried to tell you.
The droid began to protest, but Slipher just smiled.
My dear, the moon said with infinite civility, I am your schedule.
3. Hot mess.
Maul moved across the prison mess hall like a predator recently released from its cage, passing sleekly through the mob, parting it with scarcely a glance. Some of the inmates took an uneasy step back to allow him to pass, while others simply froze in place. Heads swiveled to watch him as he went. The continuous ambient drone of voices dropped to whispers, and the whispers lapsed into watchful, estimating silence as he made his way among them. He walked to the last table and sat down. On the other side of the table, two inmates who'd been in the middle of an argument, one a pallid, frightened-looking human with a four-day stubble, the other a goatle that appeared to be missing an eye, stopped talking, picked up their trays, and made a hasty departure. Maul sat motionless, observing everything around him without giving any indication that he was doing so. Although his peripheral vision still hadn't fully recovered from last night's attack, he saw enough to realize that he had become the current object of everyone's attention. Even the guards up on the catwalks overhead seemed to have gone on high alert, each with one hand on their blasters, the other resting on the small flat consoles that they wore on their belts. From both inmates and guards, Maul could smell a certain unmistakable commingling of fear, desperation, and the grinding monotony of paranoia that emerged when living things were penned up together in close quarters for indefinite spans of time.
It disgusted him. Yet, for the time being at least, it was home. He had stepped aboard this floating sewer less than 24 standard hours earlier, and in that time, he'd come to understand all that he needed to know about this place. The rest of his time inside, he knew, would simply be a question of patience, of accomplishing his mission here without being discovered for what he truly was. Neither of these things would be difficult for him. They were simply the mandates of his assignment, and as such, beyond all question. His arrival on Coghive 7 had come courtesy of the only transport of the day, a nameless prison barge with a stripped-down interior that reeked of high-carbon anthracite and unwashed flesh. The cargo hold was stocked with 37 other inmates, whose presence Maul barely registered after gauging none of them worth a moment of his time. They were a foul-smelling, nit-infested lot, comprising a dozen different species, some clearly deranged and muttering to themselves, others staring blankly through the vessel's only viewport, as if something in the depthless black void might give perspective to their pointless and insubstantial lives. Throughout it all, Maul had sat apart from his fellow inmates in absolute stillness. Some of them apparently couldn't wait to start fighting. As the trip wore on, boredom became restlessness, and scuffles had broken out, as sidelong glances and petty grievances erupted into acts of seemingly unprovoked violence. Several hours into the journey, an over-muscled ectomorph with bulging crab-stalk eyes had leapt up and lunged at a Rhodian who'd somehow managed to smuggle aboard a whip-band that he'd sharpened and apparently planned to use as a makeshift vibroblade. The fight hadn't lasted long, and only when the blade-bearer had accidentally bumped into him had Maul glanced up long enough to drive an elbow upward and shatter the Rhodian's lower spine. The guards on board hadn't even blinked as the Rhodian pitched over sideways, wailing and paralyzed, to the deck, where he lay whimpering for the duration of the trip, gazing up through moist and pleading eyes. It was the only time during the entire trip that Maul had moved. When they'd finally docked, a retinue of fatigued-looking corrections officers had met them in the hangar, herding them down the berthing port with static pikes and go sticks, running the biometric scans as the new inmates shambled forward, blinking, into the unfamiliar surroundings. Maul had seen more guards at this point in processing than anywhere else aboard the space station. At the end of the line, he stood motionless as a jumpy young CO, whose ID badge read Smite, swept a wand over him, scanning for infection and hidden weapons. There was no mistaking the tremor in the man's hand as he passed the wand in front of Maul's face.
"You know why you're here, maggot?"
Smite had asked, struggling to hide the quaver in his voice behind a pitiful note of bravado. Maul had said nothing.
22 standard hours a day, Smite told him. You're free to roam the gallery and mess hall. Twice a day, when you hear the clarion call go off, you return to your cell for matching.
The guard swallowed, the bump in his throat bulging up and down.
Any attempt to escape results in immediate termination. Failure to report back to your cell for matching will be treated as an escape attempt and will result in immediate termination. You got that?
Maul had just stared back at him, waiting for the guard to finish his business and back away. As he'd walked away, he heard the young CO find enough courage to snarl out one final declaration.
You'll die in here, maggot! They all do!
Medbay had come next. An hour's worth of decontamination and tox screens, neuro readouts and electroencephalograms,
administered by uninterested droids. After a long round of ultrasonic full-body scans, a refurbished GH-7 surgical unit had inserted a long syringe into Maul's chest and then withdrawn it, only to plunge it back in again at a slightly different angle. A final scan had confirmed whatever the droid had done to him, and the CO at the far end of the concourse had waved him forward. Afterward, two more officers armed with E-11 assault blasters had appeared and led him through a circuitous network of increasingly narrow concourses. The final walkway had led unceremoniously to his cell, a featureless alloy-plated dome, perhaps 3 meters in diameter. The carbon composite floor was the color of dirty slate. A single air vent whirred overhead. Stepping inside, Maul had sat hunched on the single narrow bench, gazing at the only light source, an unremarkable panel of blinking yellow lights on the opposite wall.
"This is where you'll come for lockdown and matching,"
one of the guards had told him. He was a grizzled older man, a veteran whose ID badge identified him as Voistock.
"You hear the clarion wherever you are. You have 5 standard minutes to get back here before lockdown, before you're terminated."
Maul looked at him coldly.
"Terminated?" "Yeah, I guess nobody told you."
The guard nodded down at the flat gray control unit strapped to his hip.
"We call this thing a drop box. Wanna know why?"
Maul just gazed at him.
"Oh, you're a hard case, right?"
"Huh?" Voistock snorted.
"Yeah, they all start out that way. Say every inmate that comes through Medbay gets a subatomic electrostatic detonator implanted in the walls of his heart. Both your hearts, since apparently you've got 2 of them. What that means is, I type in your prison number here, 11240.
He ran his fingers over the Dropbox's keypad.
"Those charges go off. And that's when you drop. Permanently."
Maul said nothing.
"But hey,"
Voistock said with a crooked grin,
"a tough guy like you shouldn't have any problems here."
He reached up and patted Maul's cheek.
"Have yourself a nice day. Right?"
They left the hatch open behind them. But Maul had stayed in his cell, crouched motionless, allowing his new surroundings to creep in around him in the slow accretion of physical detail. There were words scratched on the walls, graffiti in a dozen different languages, the usual cries of weakness, pleas for help, forgiveness, recognition, a quick death. The bench was equipped with hand grips, their surface worn smooth by hundreds of palms, as if the inmates who'd occupied the cell before him had all needed something to hold on to. Maul had dismissed this detail as irrelevant. Until the clarion had sounded. Then he had sat up, snapped into total alertness, as the panel of yellow lights in front of him stopped blinking and turned solid red. The signal keened for 5 minutes. From outside, Maul had heard voices along with the frantic scuffle and clang of footsteps on floorboards as inmates hurried back to their cells. As the alarms cut off, he heard the sounds of cells around him sealing shut. The walls had started shaking. Complicated scraping noises came from somewhere deep inside the prison's infrastructure itself, gnashing together in complicated arrangements of pneumatics. Reconfiguration. Maul looked down. The floor beneath them had already begun to bow downward into a bowl shape as the dome became a perfect sphere. And the cell had begun to turn. Only then had the well-worn hand grips on the bench made sense. He'd taken hold of them for support, hanging on as the cell rotated completely upside down and backward again, then barrel rolled sideways like a flight simulator with a broken oscillation throttle. Throughout it all, the metallic clacking and clanging continued as the various plates of his cell reshaped themselves around him. When the rotation stopped, a recessed hatchway had hissed open into what appeared to be another empty cell, thick with shadow and little else. At first, Maul had simply stood, gazing into it. Then he'd taken a step inside. By the time he'd picked up the presence of another life form behind him, the warrior with mismatched arms and the ampistaff, the first blow had already come. And now, sitting in the midst of the mess hall, feeling the eyes of the other prisoners upon him, sensing the slow accumulation of tension gathering around him like an electrically charged flow of ionized particles, Maul realized that the inmates of Coghive 7, both individually and collectively, were already planning his demise. Let them. It will only make your task easier. From everything he'd gleaned so far, the prison was an open sewer, its circular layout fostering an illusory sense of false-bottomed freedom among the incarcerated. In actuality, the prisoner's ability to roam unimpeded between fights only heightened the steadily percolating sense of animosity among them, the willingness to rip one another to pieces at the slightest provocation. Maul allowed his thoughts to cycle back to the electrostatic detonators that the droid had implanted in the chambers of both his hearts, tiny seeds of death that the population of Coghive 7 carried around with them every day. In the end, for all of these pathetic creatures, freedom was nothing but the promise of oblivion. No matter what they'd done to land themselves here, whatever they were running from or dreamed of or hoped to achieve, those detonators, mere microns in diameter, represented the totality of their lives and the ease with which they could be taken away.
"You are to locate Iram Radik,"
Sidious had told him back on Coruscant during their final moments together. And then, perhaps sensing the physical reaction that Maul himself had not quite been able to suppress, the Sith Lord had added,
"It will not be as easy as it sounds."
According to Sidious, Radik was a highly reclusive arms dealer, legendary throughout the galaxy, a ghost whose base of operations was located somewhere within Coghive 7, although no one, even Sidious himself, could confirm this fact. Radik's true identity was a closely guarded secret. As an alleged inmate in the prison, he operated exclusively behind a constantly shifting palimpsest of middlemen and fronts, guards and inmates and corrupt officials, both inside and outside its shifting walls. Those who served him, directly or indirectly, might not know whom they were working for. Or if they did, they could never have identified his face.
"You will not leave Coghive 7,
Sidious told him,
"until you have identified Radik and met with him face to face to facilitate the business at hand. Is that understood?"
It was. Maul looked around the mess hall again at the hundreds of inmates who were now staring at him openly. At the next table, two human prisoners, they appeared to be father and son, were sitting close together, as if for mutual protection. The older one, a powerfully built, scarred-looking veteran of 1,000 battles, was holding a piece of string with knots tied at carefully measured intervals, while the younger one looked on in mute fascination. Three tables down, a group of inmates hunched over their trays, groping with utensils. When one of them lifted his head, Maul realized
that the man's eyes were missing, as if they'd been gouged out of his skull. Had that happened in one of the matches? The man's hand found his fork, and he began, tentatively, to scoop food into his mouth. Across the room, another inmate, a Twi'lek, was glaring directly at Maul. Beside him, a Weequay with a sun-baked face like a desert cliff and a half-dozen topknot braids stood expressionless, watchful. Any of them could have been Radik, Maul thought. Or none of them. Maul scanned the rest of the mess hall, absorbing all of it in a single sweeping glance. There were 100 alliances here, he sensed, gangs and crews and whole webs of social order whose complexity would require his close attention if he was going to find his way among them to complete the mission for which he'd been dispatched. And time was not something he had in unlimited quantities. It was time to get to work. Picking up his tray, he dumped the remains of his meal in the nearest waste bin and cut diagonally across the mess hall. There were groups of inmates clustered around the exit, and he turned left, following the wall to a hatchway in the corner from which the smell of cheap prison food came wafting out, mixed with the stench of cleaning solution. Exactly what he was looking for. He slipped inside. Four. Coil. The prison's kitchen was like every kitchen Maul had ever been in, frantic and noisy and breathless, clamoring with enough inmates and service droids that he could slip among them without attracting much notice. Every surface was cluttered with bulk food and utensils. Massive blocks of half-thawed bantha patties dripped from the counter. Enormous pots boiled on the stove. The sticky air reeked of cheap synthetic protein, gravy and starch, all of it billowing in the steam of the massive industrialized dishwasher bolted to the floor in the corner, where endless rows of trays juddered through the scalding spray on an automated belt. Maul approached the dishwasher, studied it for a moment, and then picked up a large, unused pressure cooker from the cabinet behind him. Next to it, he found a bottle of ammonia-based cleaning solution and silica bicarbonate, poured them in together, and sealed the pressure cooker, placing it onto the conveyor belt among the trays and sending the whole thing directly into the 400-degree heat of the machine.
Hey, buddy, one of the inmates said. What's your business here?
Trouble. Maul turned around and stared at him. You want some?
The inmate went pale so quickly that his face almost seemed to disappear.
Hey, you're right, he said, hands raised, voice shaking. I didn't see anything.
Maul waited as the inmate backed away, then turned and walked out. Re-entering the mess hall, he leaned against the wall and waited. 10 seconds later, a loud metallic bang erupted from inside the kitchen, followed by shouts of surprise. The noise had an immediate effect on the mess hall. Maul watched as two gangs of inmates jumped instinctively together in response to the sound, gathering on either side. In the middle of the room, the older human fighter he'd noticed earlier swung out one hand in a protective gesture around the boy. Three inmates sprang forward, seemingly out of nowhere, placing themselves in protective stances around the Twi'lek inmate, whom Maul had seen studying him earlier. In the midst of everything, only one inmate, a diminutive Chadra fan, his growth so stunted that he scarcely stood 3 feet tall, never even looked up. Throughout it all, he continued happily eating his lunch, picking out the small bones, humming to himself as if nothing had happened. As order returned to the mess hall, Maul walked over to him and sat down directly across from him.
Hello, brother.
The Chadra fan glanced up, grinning his large front incisors fully exposed, rodent-like ears twitching as his flat, slightly upturned nose wiggled as if trying to catch a better whiff of Maul. Or perhaps he was still sniffing his breakfast, the putty-colored block of gelatinous synthetic protein clutched in his free hand. Reaching into it, he pulled out a small, thin bone and held it up appreciatively.
The greatest treasures are found in the unlikeliest of places. Don't you think?
Who are you?
Maul asked. The Tradra fan responded with a humble nod.
Coil's the name. But I'm just a microbe here. A nobody among nobodies, aren't I? You don't want to waste your time with me, brother.
Maul leaned forward to speak into his ear.
You're the only one who didn't jump when that explosion went off,
he said.
Why?
Coil smiled shyly.
Noticed you slipping into the kitchen, didn't I? Already stirring the pot a little. Did you get the information that you were looking for?
Who's the Twi'lek?
Maul asked.
The one those other inmates moved in to protect.
The Chadra fan ignored the question, sizing Maul up from across the table.
Big one, aren't you? A lot bigger than you looked on that hollow vid.
He crammed the remains of his meal into his mouth, chewed for a moment, and then stopped, fishing out another bone and placing it on the growing collection in the corner of his tray.
I'm looking for someone,
Maul said.
Aren't we all?
Coil asked pleasantly enough, brushing the last of the crumbs from his whiskers.
Quite a brawl last night, wasn't it? Off that ugly torso in less than 5 standard minutes, didn't you? Brother needs some wicked fierce skills to fight like that, doesn't he then? And we ask ourselves, who trains the Rekka to do his wrecking?
I'm looking for Iram Radik.
Radik then, is it?
Coil narrowed his eyes and scratched the tuft of hair between his ears.
Nope. Can't say I know that name, do I? Never heard of him. Not around here. Not likely. No, sir.
Maul shifted his gaze across the mess hall to the two gangs that had come together when the explosion had gone off in the kitchen. In the ensuing moments, they'd loosened up and spread out again slightly, but the social fabric was still clear enough. One crew had gathered in the far right corner near the place where inmates had come spilling into the hall from the cafeteria line, maybe 2 dozens in all. This group was all human, their heads shaved, their ears and noses pierced with what looked like bits of bone. Maul could tell just from the way they were standing that they were holding something hidden in their uniforms, inside their sleeves, tucked up into their tunics. Something sharp and secret. Across the room, a second group stood, a human and non-human mix, with a vicious-looking Nogri positioned in front of them, clearly their leader. They'd all cut the right sleeves off their uniforms to expose a series of matching tattoos that spiraled from wrist to shoulder. At first glance, they were a more random ragtag group, and it made them look primitive and dangerous. Their gaze shifted from Maul to the other group and back to Maul again.
What about them?
Maul asked.
The two crews? Bone Kings and the Gravity Massive. Vas Nailhead runs the Kings.
He nodded at an enormous, thickly bearded human with sharpened incisors.
And the Gravity Massive answers to Strabo over there.
He switched his attention to a hairless, gray-skinned Nogri on the opposite side, accompanied by an attentive Nelvanian sidekick.
Me personally? I wouldn't go messing with none of them, brother. Don't know much besides killing, do they? And even that's a stretch for most of them, isn't it?
And the Twi'lek.
Maul said.
What's his name?
Twi'lek?
Coil blinked.
Got no name, doesn't he? Not one I've heard. We just call him Zero, doesn't we?
Zero.
As in inmate Zero. On account of he's been here from the beginning.
Why is he protected?
Coyle gave him a shrug.
Zero's always been the one who can get things.
What things?
He's the one with three eyes.
Maul frowned.
Three eyes?
Items, influence, information.
Another shrug from the Chandra fan, who was back to sorting through his collection of small bones.
Always been that way, hasn't it? Least since I've been here.
Maul turned to direct his stare at the place the Twi'lek had been standing when the explosion had gone off in the kitchen. Now he was gone, as if he'd simply vanished amid the rest of Gen Pop.
If I wanted to find him again, where would I look?
Oh, Zero,
the Chandra fan considered.
Oh, I suppose he's been known to visit Ventilation Conduit 11 AZR. Is maybe one place he's been known to entertain visitors from time to time. Of course, that's just hearsay, isn't it? Nothing guaranteed, is there?
Conduit 11 AZR,
Maul repeated.
That's right, but...
Maul had already turned to walk away.
Five. Knockout Mouse.
That's him,
Egan whispered.
He's the one, isn't he?
The man leaning against the wall next to him with his hands in his pockets didn't have to look up to know whom his son was referring to. Even if the boy hadn't been talking about the new champion all morning, ignoring his breakfast and then loitering shamelessly around the gallery in hopes of catching a glimpse of the red-skinned newcomer, it would have been obvious. Upon reflection, it struck Artigan Truax that from the moment he'd come to Coghive 7, his 16-year-old son's day-to-day existence here had always been focused on the prison's current champion. Either fearing the day that he'd have to fight him, or idolizing him from afar. Or, perhaps both.
Yes, that's the one,
Artigan said, still not raising his eyes as the new inmate strode past them 20 meters away. As you well know.
I hear he answers to Jagannath,
Egan said.
A mercenary and hired killer wanted in a dozen different systems. They say it means the tooth,
the man said with a nod, bemused at the boy's enthusiasm. Yes, I've heard that as well.
Do you think...
The question trailed off as Egan struggled to phrase it in some way that sounded offhand.
I mean, just supposing, if I had to, if it came down to it in a match, if I kept up my training, do you think I could ever...
Artigan didn't respond right away. He had never enjoyed withholding the truth from his son. And before the two of them had come here, he'd sworn an oath to always be absolutely honest with him. He owed the boy that much. After dragging Egan from one end of the galaxy to the other, making him stand at the edge of the crowd watching as Artigan took punch after punch, night after night, in an endless series of pit fights and loading bay brawls, the truth was the least he could offer. Yet again, today, he found himself incapable of speaking it.
We fail ourselves again and again, he thought. Every day. It's what we do.
You're almost ready,
he said, reaching out to toss the boy's fine reddish-brown hair.
Another month or two of training, heavy training, mind you, with no backing down when it becomes difficult, ought to do the trick.
Egan's face lit up, and he turned to his father, hope shimmering in those pale green eyes.
Really?
No doubt in my mind,
Artigan said, putting on what he hoped was a reassuring smile. Unable to sustain the artifice any longer, he turned his attention back to the throng of inmates all around them.
Go down and wait for me in the metal shop.
You'll chase rats today.
Yes, sir,
Egan smiled.
I'll meet you there.
He turned and walked away, edging through the crowds of prisoners. Artigan watched him go, the smile fading from his face.
No doubt in my mind, he'd said. But there were doubts. All kinds of them.
It had been almost a year since they'd first arrived here, father and son. Scooped up alongside a handful of counterfeiters and low-level street enforcers, and plunged unceremoniously into Coghive 7's festering soup of sociopaths, killers, and thugs. But regardless of what the boy thought, it had not been an accident. Such was the deal that Artigan Truax had made with the shadowy hand of the galaxy. Since his arrival here, he had been matched a total of 5 times. He had triumphed in the first 3 of those matches, providing speedy, deliberate kills. Still strong and fast, with reflexes honed over 3 decades of fighting, he'd dispatched his opponents quickly, and even enjoyed a brief moment of celebrity among the population. The 4th match, however, against a caliche whose tusks were sharpened to surgical points, had not gone as well. Those tusks had gouged into his chest wall, puncturing his lung. Artigan had managed to snap one of them off and use it against the caliche in a stroke of good luck. Once again, he'd emerged battered, but victorious. And the fifth match had nearly killed him. He'd been pitted against a Klaatu-Inian, and he'd known right away that he was in trouble. 2 minutes in, the thing had smashed him in the temple so hard that Artigan had almost lost consciousness. The pain was worse than anything he'd ever experienced, and amid it all, the beckoning promise of unconsciousness had been so seductive that Artigan had actually wanted to leap down into it, if only for a brief reprieve. Only the notion of leaving Egan alone here, unprotected amid a sea of predators, had kept him from blacking out completely. Rallying, he had managed, barely, to hold on long enough to twist the Klaatu-Inian's battle axe away and bury the blade in his opponent's skull. He had not been matched again. But the damage was done. The Klaatu-Inian's blow to his skull had capped off a career of closed head injuries and concussions. And ever since then, Artigan suffered chronic migraines, nausea, and night sweats. His vision, once his greatest asset, so keen and clear that he'd been able to see an ambush reflected in his opponent's pupils, had gone foggy around the edges. Sometimes he awoke to dazzling halos of opalescent light, auras that he'd come to associate with the onset of excruciating pain. He'd developed a slight tremor, and once, 2 months ago, he had a seizure, thankfully after Egan had already fallen asleep. When the boy had rolled over in his bunk and muttered sleepily to his father, Artigan had assured him it was only a dream. After that, he'd smuggled a spoon out of the mess hall and slept with it clamped between his teeth, just in case it happened again, to keep him from biting his tongue. These days, whenever he was out among Genpop, he kept his hands tucked in the pockets of his prison uniform to hide the way they trembled. He hid that from the boy as well, although how successfully he didn't know. All the strength and poise and confidence that he'd brought to the ring were gone. Some mornings he could barely see straight, let alone fight. In his 55th year of life, he'd become what the other inmates referred to as a knockout mouse. A former champion who'd hit the ceiling of his abilities and was waiting for the inevitable final bout. The one that would kill him.
Heard you were looking for me.
Artigan half turned, hands still tucked in the front pockets of his prison tunic, and saw the grizzled old guard Voistock, standing just behind the semi-opaque mesh of wire and transparasteel, blaster in hand. How long the CO had been standing there, Artigan didn't know. He hadn't heard him approach over the noise of the gallery. Leaning backward, careful to keep his eyes on the crowds of inmates passing in front of him and not to move his lips, Artigan spoke just loud enough to be heard.
"Appreciate you coming." "Skip it," Voistock said. "You got something for me or not?"
Artigan's right hand came out of his pocket to reveal a finger-thin stretch of polymer filament string, carefully coiled. He slipped it through the mesh into the guard's waiting palm. Voistock took the string, shook it out, and stretched it in front of him, scowling at it.
"What the kark is this?"
"The item that we spoke of earlier."
"You promised me 30,000 credits,
Voistock sneered.
"Told me you had an off-world private bank account with an untapped balance."
"Officer, look at what I gave you. What do you see?"
"A piece of string," Voistock said. "A lousy stretch of thread you pulled off your shirt cuff. And another maggot trying to weasel his way out of getting matched."
He tossed the filament to the permacrete floor beneath his boots and was already turning around to disappear back to wherever he'd come from.
"You waste my time like this again, and you aren't going to wait for your next bout to get your ticket punched. You understand what I'm telling you, you worthless puke?"
"Wait," Artigan said. His head was starting to ache in that old familiar place behind his left eye.
"Just look at it. Please."
Something of the desperation in his voice must have given the guard pause, because Voistock stopped, leaning down to pick up the filament again and holding it up for a better look. The glow of recessed lighting shimmered off the array of tiny knots tied throughout the filament, whole clusters of them, none any bigger than the glint of light reflected in the guard's suspicious gaze. When Artigan spoke again, his voice was quiet and patient. "There are over 6 billion different knots in the galaxy, Officer Voistock. Each one reads like a specific deformation of a circle in three-dimensional space, as unique as individual letters in an alphabet." Voistock grunted.
"Huh. Is that supposed to mean anything to me?"
"What you're holding in your hand is called a kipu," Artigan said, "also known as a talking knot. Any droid with the most basic analytical drive will be able to unravel each knot's linking integral. It shouldn't take more than 30 seconds. You'll end up with a 21-digit number."
"What? Like a code?"
Artigan nodded. "The first 12 digits of this kipu make up the ID reference for the orbital account off Moonalinst with a balance of 30,000 credits. The last 9 are the password to access all those funds." He flicked his eyes up at Voistock. "See for yourself."
"Nuts."
The guard snorted, but he slipped the filament into his own pocket.
"You're as crazy as a mutant womp rat, old man. You know that."
Artigan smiled thinly. "You wouldn't be the first to make that observation."
"Say you are telling the truth,"
Voistock said.
"You want to tell me how a washed-up chunk of Minok dung like you gets his meat hooks on that kind of cash?"
"Winnings," Artigan said. "Saved up from 15 years of fights."
"There's no way you could make that much in pit fights."
"I was saving for my retirement." Artigan cocked a bushy eyebrow at the gallery and its inhabitants. "I never thought I'd be spending it here."
"Retirement, huh?"
This time Voistock actually chuckled.
"You got a funny way of looking at things, old man, you know that?"
"Perhaps we both do."
"How do you figure?"
"We both spend our days walking around this floating slice of hell," Artigan said. "Just on different sides of the wire, that's all." Voistot glared at him narrowly.
Yeah, well, one big difference between us is I'm not walking around with a bomb inside my heart,
he said, reaching down to the flat-packed drop box on his belt.
6 digits, and down you go permanently. Maybe you could use a reminder of that.
Wait.
Artigan looked at him, eyebrows raised. If I've done something to offend you...
You know, I don't even have to justify this to the warden.
A narrow, almost cunning look stole over Voistock's face, something that couldn't really be called a smile.
All I have to say is that the prisoner posed a threat. No board of inquiry, no paperwork. Shoot, I don't even have to report it. That's how disposable you are.
He leaned in.
Where's your kid?
Now just wait a moment.
A sudden bolt of panic shot across Artigan's face.
What are you doing?
Just a little demonstration.
Voistock reached down to his dropbox and tapped a series of digits onto the console.
Your boy is inmate 11033, right?
Please don't.
Voistock shrugged.
Too late.
He hit enter. Artigan didn't move. 2 meters off to his right, a Volpterine inmate who'd been leaning with his back to the wall went suddenly rigid. And then his tusked face went abruptly slack. Knees buckling, he slid down against the wall and crumpled to a heap on the floor of the gallery. For a moment, the other prisoners in the area gave the Volpterine a sidelong glance, then went along with their business as a clanking, balky, Class 5 treadwell droid rolled over, hooked its manipulators to the corpse's ankles, and began to drag it away.
Whoops.
Voistock shrugged.
Must have typed the numbers in wrong.
He flicked his eyes up at Artigan.
Next time, I'll make sure I get him right.
The CO returned his attention to the Kipu, running his fingers over the cryptic arrangement of the knots.
This better be legit.
It is.
Artigan's skull was pounding so hard that his eyeballs felt like they were going to squeeze right out of their sockets. And more than anything, he yearned for the silence and darkness of a quiet corner in his cell. But the canny part of him realized that any indication of weakness might ruin the faint flicker of trust between himself and the guard.
If you're yanking me on this,
Voistock said,
it's not going to end pretty for you or your boy. You see that now, don't you?
Artigan just nodded.
Just take it.
The CO's eyes narrowed.
And in return, what? You want me to make sure you don't get matched again? Protect that youngling of yours?
He shook his head.
What is you've been training him hard on your own? Trying to teach him the 52 fists? Get him ready for his first match? You think he actually stands a chance in there?
Artigan drew in a slow breath through his teeth. Releasing it seemed to cost him something deep and heartfelt that he would have preferred to keep to himself indefinitely.
No,
he admitted in a voice barely above a whisper. The boy's not a fighter. A blind man could see that. He's fast enough, I suppose, and he's growing stronger every day. But he's no killer. And that's not something you can teach. It hurt to say these things out loud. All the terrible certainties that he'd mulled over in private, night after sleepless night. But it was also a relief to give them voice and hear them spoken aloud. And I know there's nothing you can do to keep either of us from being matched again. That's well outside your scope of influence.
So what then?
Voistock glared at him, visibly annoyed.
You can't honestly tell me that you're just handing over your life savings to me for no reason.
Artigan shook his head.
Not at all. Then what do you want?
I want something much bigger, Hartigan said.
I want you to help us escape.
Six. The whole thing runs on blood. 20 minutes later, Siddiqui and Vesto Slipher were taking the turbo lift down through the levels of Coghive 7. The moon standing quietly on his side of the lift, with his hands folded together, and the same slight inscrutable smirk on his lips. Seeing it now, Siddiqui found that she didn't like that smirk any more than she had 20 minutes earlier.
Our loan payments are up to date, she told the moon. I really don't see why the IBC should have any reason to investigate our operations here.
Investigate is perhaps too piquant a word, Slipher said, gazing placidly at the lift's readout. You may consider this a routine audit, if you prefer.
And is it standard protocol to dispatch top-level executives on routine audits?
The moon beamed at her as if conceding some minor point. I see. In fact, to be perfectly frank, Warden, Coghive 7 is something of a unique case in the IBC's Outer Rim portfolio. Of course, there's no question of your profitability or the ongoing security of our investment here.
So if we're all so in love with each other, Siddiqui asked, why the sudden interest in our operation?
Oh, the moon said. I assure you there's nothing new about our interest in Coghive 7, Warden. The lift began to slow down. If anything, the IBC has always been highly sensitive to the unique particulars of your rather spectacular success out here in the middle of nowhere.
The smile returned, as pleasant as ever.
After all, what you're doing here is another form of gambling. Yet unlike the casinos, pod racing courses, and sabacc parlors that the IBC bankrolls, your operation never seems to have a bad fiscal quarter.